I teach ethics for both hypnosis and biofeedback. And one of the things we teach people is if something's experimental, if it hasn't become state of the art, you have to tell your patient. But that doesn't mean you can't offer to do it.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. We continue this week highlighting our key programs, and today we feature our outstanding mind-body medicine program faculty discussing a range of topics from hypnosis, nutrition, healthcare access, and much more. You're not going to want to miss this collective set of excellent insights, wisdom, and more from these fabulous faculty members who walk that talk, providing important observations about how we can achieve greater holistic health across all walks of life. All right, let's get to it with mind-body medicine in action. How much has the college grown? How have you seen it evolve in ways, in your perspective, that has been unique or interesting?
Well, it's been exciting to grow the college. The original 2 degrees, the Department of Mind-Body Medicine with its master's and PhD, is now approaching 250 students. The college itself is close to 450 students. We added a Department of Integrative and Functional Nutrition. We had, from the beginning, had nutrition courses. But we were able to add first a master's degree and then more recently a PhD in integrative and functional nutrition. And we do believe that we are what we eat, that food is one of the best forms of medicine. So I'm delighted to have that degree. We took in a program that I had actually taught for before, and that was is now our Department of Applied Psychophysiology. It had been a freestanding graduate school then affiliated with Saybrook in order to get accreditation for its 2 graduate programs, a master's and a PhD in applied psychophysiology. That program has some remarkable adjunct and salaried faculty, highly capable, some of the best teachers in the field of psychophysiology. Finally, we've added the Department of Integrative Social Work, and this has been a dream of ours for at least 10 years. Eric Wilmarth and I kept talking about it, and I was delighted when the university came to us and said that we have a possibility to collaborate with another school within the TCS education system family. Pacific Oaks College would take on a bachelor's and a master's, and we would do the PhD. And that program has grown. I was able to recruit Trent Wynn to head social work, and we are growing somewhere in the mid-30s right now, I believe, in the number of students, which for a new PhD program is excellent. And we've got a great curriculum there. I think it's important. The pandemic has shown us we can't be individual in focus. We have to look at the community, public health, community health, the health of the entire community, or we're not going to have healthy individuals.
I didn't realize all the self-talk and the anxiety that was kind of suppressed within and how that kind of changed things. When you say that it was transformational and you saw this door swing open to other possibilities and you've been able to, I don't know, self-regulate a little bit, is that too far? Is that a fair word or a fair phrase to use? I mean, what all kind of came about for you in that transformational process?
A commitment to an internal kindness, I would say, would be the first thing. And then more ease in that arising. So I remember I came back from that meditation retreat, and this sort of answers some of your question before, and I found little ways of dropping in. So I, in my own mind, invented a little practice and then later found that to be the first practice that was in a curriculum that I learned from others, of just ringing, you know, a little meditation bell and having the kids raise one hand when the sound disappeared. So that's 30 to 40 seconds as a whole class comes in. And when I'm working with hundreds and hundreds of kids, or when I was working, that was too much for my nervous system. And I eventually learned that by my increased sensitivity. But having that moment settling when highly dysregulated kids come into a room was really profound. And after that first retreat, I would meditate. I started with a 5-minute a morning practice, and I was so proud of myself. And I often talk about this one moment when I had a class, they came in, they sat down, they were all facing me, and one kid turns completely around to face the kid behind him. And I opened my mouth, ready to have my, you know, stern teacher voice. I don't remember the kid's name, but you turn around, you know. And I'm not quite that stern, but like internally, that was the orientation of like, frustration. And I opened my mouth, and what came out was a very sweet, like, hey, kiddo, I love your hair, but I'd really rather see your face right now.
What exactly is psychophysiology?
Well, and I'll add a word to that because our department specifically is applied psychophysiology. So, you know, it's taking the science of physiology and looking at the applications on it. But, you know, my elevator speech for that is that it's the science behind mind-body medicine. Psychophysiology, of course, you break it down, psycho, mind, physiology, body. So it is a mind-body approach, but it's looking at the actual underpinnings of it so that we actually measure what's going on in the body, whether we're talking about, you know, heart rate variability or muscle tension or brainwave activity. There are a lot of biological markers within the body that respond to the environment, including thought.
Maybe if we could spend a couple minutes talking about the work you've been thinking about doing in practice around decolonization and Jedi work. Maybe just speak to that from your own background would be interesting for just a few minutes, if we could.
It's not as far-fetched as you would think, because it is actually an aspect, and you know, I've had many conversations around that, how my ethno-sanitological work, especially as approach from a decolonial praxis, is work in social justice and actually has a very direct thread to thanatology and the concepts around that, particularly where Ernest Becker's work is and terror management theory, who basically, and that's a whole other conversation, as you said, but in a nutshell, the thoughts around our death anxiety drives an awful lot of unpleasant behavior.
Look at kind of the landscape of integrative medicine and healthcare right now. And we're going to get into some details around the healthcare industry because I know you teach the healthcare leadership, mindful leadership specialization. But I am curious where you see things headed in terms of integrative medicine and health, because you were on the really ground floor with massage therapy. You've seen it evolve. What's happening, churning right now in this space as it relates to mind-body medicine, et cetera?
You know, Nathan, that's an excellent question, and it's one that we continue to ask ourselves. And because this is it's a scholarship-based program, I monitor the research every day. I'm watching to see what's going on in research, but I'm also active in practice. So I stay involved with what's going on in a practice level. So for an example, 10 years ago, integrative medicine was not a term. We talked about what I'm doing, what we're teaching is CAM, complementary and alternative medicine. So NIH changed that. They changed the terminology. And the words we use are powerful. We believe that, right? Because we're scholars. So it's the way that we write things, the way we talk about things, and the system. Because I see this very much as a system of healthcare delivery and healthcare consumption and healthcare promotion, as well as healthcare as an aspect of mind, body, spirit. So what's happened over the last few years in integrative healthcare has been really interesting. Up until about 3 years ago, I think we'd all anticipated that integrative medicine had an opportunity that came out of the opioid crisis. And that in large part is because there was a turn away from pharmacological interventions because in many cases they just were not working. And we have seen repeated cases of trauma. For example, the U.S. military is one of the largest consumers of integrative healthcare to this day. The VA system has been instrumental in very different places across the country in introducing different practices. So initially, we were looking at things like massage therapy, chiropractic, or acupuncture as components. And now we have a better understanding that it's an entire system that is what can be part of the movement, changing the way we deliver and experience healthcare.
I was just curious, when Lauren and you came together and others about the vision for this, you know, maybe talk a bit about the evolution, because I believe you all started with about 9 or 11 students, is that right? Back in...
Well, I'll talk about that. First of all, let me just say, our team was Jeannie Achterberg, Lynn Freeman, Lauren Buckman, James Gordon, and myself. And we developed a curriculum, and we our initial degrees were a master's and a PhD in mind-body medicine. It was interesting because we already included things that go beyond mind-body practices. We included things like food as nutrition, nutrition as an integral part of integrative care. We began with closer to 24 students, I believe, in the fall of 2009. It was an exciting time. We had students who came to us feeling like they had found their calling by finding the College of what then was called College of Mind-Body Medicine. One woman had been searching for about 8 years. She'd read about psychoneuroimmunology, and she just was determined that she was going to find some place where she could study this intersection of mind, body, the nervous system, the endocrine system, the psychology of the person all in one place. And she became part of our first cohort and, in fact, became our first PhD graduate.
Through you when you first started graduate work here at Saybrook, and like what excited you most? What got you really freaked out, worried, and how did you manage it all? Probably mindfulness is one of those things, but yeah.
I think the thing that excited me most was going to my first RC and the very pervasive feeling that these are my people, that these are my people who want to dive deep into similar topics as me and a similar sort of mindset for, towards the mind-body integrative field, and a lot of joy in that. As I already said, I was so excited about the classes themselves, the topics that I would be learning.
Psychophysiology connected or sort of a sister or cousin to neuropsychology? What are the interfaces there? So with brain research and the work going on there.
Right. Well, yeah, we use the term biofeedback, but it's actually there are multiple different types of feedback we can get. When we talk about EEG or neurofeedback, that's basically feedback of what's going on in the brain, and that's probably our most direct to with neuropsychology of actually understanding what's happening in the brain with things. So if I like to go to hypnosis examples, you know, during an fMRI, you can see in real time the effect that different suggestions have on different aspects of the brain. So we can actually target suggestions now to aim at the amygdala if we're looking at, you know, feelings of safety or comfort. You know, working in the world of pain management, you can make suggestions specifically aimed at the sensory strip so that, you know, you can talk about sensations of warmth or decreasing of pain. But never before have we been able to actually see what happens. You know, hypnosis has been around for over 300 years, but now the whole neuroscience field has energized it because we can actually see and target what we're saying and what effect it has on the person. And even better, the person can see and feel that same thing themselves so that they can, again, you know, feel more control over a situation rather than to be dependent on some kind of a pharmacological. And to your point about the integration, I like how the language has changed because we started off with this concept of alternative medicine. Unfortunately, people saw that as an alternative to medicine, and there was kind of a us against them, you know. Then we moved to complementary medicine to try to avoid that. And now the term integrative medicine, I think, is closer to the idea that, you know, everyone belongs in the room, and that, you know, we don't have to have it us against them as we look at the patient as a center part and say what's going to be most effective in helping them get to some matter of health.
Is grief?
Grief is the healthy expected response to loss. And just as there are different kinds of grief, there are different kinds of losses. And some of the losses that are quite present in this moment as we are still navigating the impacts of the pandemic, there's no post-racial experience, no post-colonial, and we're definitely not in a post-pandemic experience. So let's just rest there for a moment. So given that, There are non-death losses, right? And we can think of quite a few of those experiences from the pandemic. There are secondary losses that are also related to grief. So those are things like when I'm caregiving, if your beloved who has died was the primary breadwinner in your family, now the secondary loss compared to that can be resources.
As you look at some of the treatment methods that integrative medicine can contribute to, especially like with long COVID, this is fascinating to me because I don't even think I put those two things together recently. So you're helping create those synaptic connections here. What do those treatments maybe look like in concert with traditional Western medical techniques? I mean, what's kind of coming top of mind for you right now as a practitioner?
For myself and for my friends, I consult regularly with my naturopathic friends and colleagues who are in practice and what they're experiencing. I'm monitoring the literature around that. Things like brain fog is surfacing to the top when long COVID, there's problems with that. We have found that some supplements have been very effective in mitigating the effects of brain fog. So we have supplements that are one aspect of a product, and there are models in integrative healthcare that explain this. There are also body-mind interventions, and that can move from meditation and mindfulness practices to some of the mindfulness therapies such as Feldenkrais, Alexander work, or anisomatic education, which one of my students just defended his dissertation on last week. One of the first places that we have documented anisomatic education work. So there are practices that will be able to help with that. Individually, people are showing up with a wide range of long COVID symptoms. And there are opportunities in all of the sectors in complementary integrative medicine to be able to match up with possibilities. And because integrative medicine advisory nature is client-centered, patient-centered, we can take a look and provide a menu of possibilities. And the research is starting to come out. There are places in the world where they did not have the medicinal or pharmaceutical remedies that we did, and they were treating COVID-19 in their hospitals with vitamin C, with vitamin D, with what are the effects of melatonin, so that's on the supplement side. How does meditation and mindfulness practice mitigate the brain fog and help with the mood disorders that are also showing up to be rampant as part of the side effects long term? Lots of opportunities here.
Find something isn't efficacious, we don't want to be using it to the detriment of the patient, the client, but we're not going to find that out if we gatekeep these studies too, right? If we gatekeep the research is happening. I'm not suggesting it's happening more all over the place now, but I think that has been also a contributing factor to the inability for some of these studies. Do you agree? Do you not agree? I mean,
I totally agree. I teach ethics for both hypnosis and biofeedback. And one of the things we teach people is if something's experimental, if it hasn't become state of the art, you have to tell your patient. But that doesn't mean you can't offer to do it. If you've had good results with it, and there have been some small studies showing good results, and the patient has already tried the mainstream remedies and hasn't benefited, most patients will want to try something.
What was it like working full-time and going to school? And you did it, obviously, and I know you made a choice or a change in that path, but maybe describe that experience for you.
Things felt more meaningful, working towards something new, especially returning to school after having been out. I was just trying to do the math in my head. Eight-ish, 9 years after my master's. There was for me a really renewed energy, some real space. I did not have space between my undergraduate and my master's. So having had some more life experience, some more space was really helpful. And I really devoted a lot of time to the reading. And I would try to have that be nourishing. So I would have like a full day of reading, or I'd go read in the park when I could.
Talk about how psychophysiology techniques are applied, say, by a counselor or a psychologist who may get a certificate in this area or some additional skills. What does that look like in the therapy room? And, you know, maybe some examples. Yeah.
Very early on, when I first was involved with biofeedback, I had a patient hooked up so I could measure, heart rate and galvanic skin response and some basic peripheral measures. And I think we were just doing some basic guided imagery. And I had him imagining himself at the beach, sun beating down on him, the sound of the waves. And I glanced over at the screen and the thing was going off the chart. And so I stopped and asked him what was happening because he didn't say anything and he looked fine. But it turned out that his best friend had drowned 2 weeks before. So while I was enjoying a lovely scene at the beach that I was describing, I was probably torturing him because he was picturing his buddy being pulled out of the street.
The George Floyd situation, we won't call it situation, he's murdered, but the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, I wonder if you could categorize that almost as a secondary response to the larger long-term, long-standing grief that has been affecting so many people of color, Black people in particular, over centuries, and it came out in this massive set of protests and this ongoing work. Maybe that's a terrible way to metaphor it. I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's not even a metaphor. You are right on point because I've had this conversation many times, not only in community, but also with our students, that Black Lives Matter is a direct lived experience of all these mothers who have lost their children to police violence. And so in the time of the triple pandemics, when we began all of this work together and were first navigating the ambiguous losses of COVID, there were the very real, complicated, traumatic losses that were a result of the racial trauma that was occurring at this time through police violence. And then again, the other simmering pandemic underneath that with health disparities of who was getting the appropriate treatment and who also was dying and not dying from COVID at that time. But yes, so you think of, on a more macro scale, we're getting to issues of intergenerational trauma. So which of course does include intergenerational grief. I remember someone saying the other day when you are speaking, sometimes the tears choking you are not even your own, but the grief of other generations.
What's going on from your perspective? And you alluded to this a little bit in your opening remarks around systems and the systemic approach to analysis and understanding. So I'd be curious what your thoughts are on this. And maybe let's start with transparency in healthcare. What does that look like? And we can kind of go in and out of these topics as you feel comfortable.
Thank you. Transparency is sort of interesting because there's an increasing body of literature that's building up around medical mistrust. So that's not directly related to how I will respond to your systems question, but I think it's critical because it's not just in the United States, it's globally too. And it's been a particular problem during COVID.
Yeah.
Because if you don't trust the very people who are holding the vaccine to be able to take care of your health and wellness, then we are all in a lot of trouble. In the United States, we have an interesting situation because we are beyond reach, the most expensive healthcare system in the world. For example, I think several years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Cuba and take a look. They're very interested in how they integrated healthcare down there, which is sort of funny in looking back on it because they don't have to integrate healthcare, they just have healthcare. And like when I talked to my father about organic gardening, he's been gardening.
That's right. That's a great point.
In Cuba, they have roughly the same outcomes that we do in terms of life expectancy, in terms of chronic illness, but their cost per individual is less than 1/10 of our cost. And yet we still have it is staggering, and still in this country, we have millions of people who are not only, the big problem is not that they are not insured, but they are underinsured, that they are one cataclysmic illness away from being in bankruptcy and or being homeless. And then we have this other whole problem. So I will not miss the opportunity to pitch the idea of social determinants of health and how important that is, the way we in the Department of Mind Body Medicine curriculum look at health and wellness, that it is not simply one thing. It's not the service that you get. However, back to your question about our healthcare system in the States, we have one of the most complex systems that you can find anywhere. And if you take apart all of the stakeholders, including the lobbyists, including the pharmaceutical companies, including the regulatory bodies, there are so many people and bodies that are involved that don't have to do with delivering healthcare, that they have to do with ensuring healthcare or not ensuring healthcare or tracking who insures healthcare, or we can go on and on with all of the stakeholders that are involved here in the United States. So the alternative is very simple, but it's not necessarily very popular, and that is to niche while healthcare and to eliminate all of the bodies that don't have to do with delivering and inserting about.
Wow, Luann.
All right, so quick take on meditation.
Meditation is becoming the most widely used and accepted complementary practice. It's not new. It's thousands of years old, but we have good research. Neuroimaging does show changes in the brain when we meditate. Research shows that our telomeres, those little caps, those little legs on the DNA, actually get healthier when we meditate, when we do longer-term meditation. So there's a lot of benefits that are measurable, which I think is helping make it acceptable to the medical profession, but it's also transformative. I meditate almost every day, and I'm a better person for it. Years ago, I had a friend who was a horrible person. He was hard to be around. After his midday meditation, he was a much nicer person. So meditation is powerful.
The challenges that may have emerged during your course of study, how did you mitigate some of those? Like, you know, what was your approach to dealing with those, especially, you know, maybe in the heat of a course or dealing with your dissertation?
Crying a lot. I'm trying to think. So I have a master's in library science. So I have a research degree prior to getting a research degree. And I took the research sequence over again, or I took the research sequence, even though I think I could have passed out of it, to have a really fresh sense of what I was learning and how to use it. And I would say I really wanted to do really well. And sometimes I did not. I ended up, so what I noticed is a lot of with myself and with some of my classmates is really transformative experiences happening in my own life parallel to being in Saybrook that I couldn't have imagined, that I think came from a sense of opening, from being part of the program and part of the community.
Give me an example maybe of yourself or someone doing clinical psychology therapy.
Well, you know, one of the famous things in biofeedback is it's a great way to make a small fortune out of a large one, because we have lots of really expensive equipment that we can use, but there are also things like $20 digital thermometer that you could hook up to the finger, because when we relax, the blood flows out to the extremities. And, you know, if you can teach people to warm their hands, the only way you warm your hands is by getting that blood that's circulating out at 98.6 degrees out to the extremities. When we're in stress, blood goes to the heart and the brain, you know, our survival modes. But you've heard the phrase, someone was frozen in terror. Well, they are feeling very cold because they don't have any circulation out there. Right? Just as if they're boiling mad, there may be, you know, the heart's pumping away. And so a lot of our very common expressions are very psychophysiologically based. You know, when someone gets under your skin and you're all tight, well, that's where your muscles are and things. So it's learning that some of those things are not only real every day, but there's some things that you can manage and you can control and self-regulate, and we don't need external things like drugs to do that, that you can learn skills to do it. So
we have so many interesting folks that come to us as students. So doctors, surgeons, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants. I mean, I've met a few of them. You've met all of them, or presumably a lot of them. And, you know, I'm curious as to why you think it is that they choose to come to Saybrook for this mind-body medicine degree program, or what one of our many programs, but I want to focus today on MBM. What are some of the reasons you hear from them? And then I guess kind of a quick follow-up to that is, what are they doing with the degree? Where are they at with that?
Well, some of those people are the same heroes I talked about because they've got a vision. You know, it's part of their vision, and then they're going to go on to hold it for others too. So, I don't think this is for the faint to take on a whole new territory. We're in new territory, you know. But I was doing that too. But when I was in my doctoral program, I remember one of my mentors told me that the job I was going to have hadn't been invented yet. Mm. And he was right. But all we need to do is look around us right now and see how quickly the world is changing and know that we need some innovative thinkers who can look at things differently. And also appreciate that what we've been doing in many regards in healthcare has not worked so well. So, you know, if you're called to conventional medicine, there are many different ways for you to go down. But if you're called to innovate in a different sort of way, Saybrook offers something that is completely unique in our mind-body medicine.
That's great. That's great. And so these physicians or healthcare practitioners who come from that space see us and find us. What are you seeing them doing in terms of scholarship and application?
And, you know, it depends on the individual. Some of them are taking what they have learned here, what they've researched here, and how they have developed, because this is a transformative program. And they're going out and they're introducing new programs. And it's some incredible examples of that out there right now. Others go back to their niche, whatever it was, be it a psychotherapist or an occupational or massage therapist, but they're doing it much broader, bigger ways. They might be leading organizations while they're doing that. And that we're seeing also a change in our students as integrative medicine changes more and more to shift to the individual learning how to take better care of themselves. More and more educators are coming to us. And I know just
interesting.
Yeah, not just educators who are I've got students who are teaching in the primary school. I have those who are teaching in community colleges, and they want to take the work that they're doing as educators to a higher level. That really excites me.
That is awesome. All right, what about Reiki?
Oh, that's Reiki is very interesting because it's an energy therapy, and yet it's in a lot of medical settings. A study was done about 3 years ago on a large sample with almost 100 practitioners, and they found positive benefits for quite a few medical disorders, pain, nausea, appetite problems, shortness of breath, depression. Patients love it. Patients love the soothing feeling of Reiki. Now, is it placebo? I don't know. I don't think we have the research on that yet. I'd like to see more neuroimaging studies and physiological studies done on Reiki. But we do know it feels good. Patients sleep better. They get more relaxed. Well, that's all therapeutic benefit. And then it seems to impact on medical disorders. Cancer wards, people have less nausea and less pain.
I want to know what you did for your research and how you're applying it today. Like, what did that look like? And you know, the experience of doing dissertation research, what was that like for you?
So my topic was children's experiences using mindfulness in daily life. And I did qualitative research, as I just am in my heart a really qualitative researcher. And I used my teaching notes from when I taught mindfulness to pull up all those statements that I had written down that children had used to get to a hermeneutic phenomenological understanding of how the children used the mindfulness when they weren't with me, or how they applied what they had learned when they were with me. And throughout that process, I had also, it was very interesting, I had taken sort of a passion pivot and got really interested in grief and death. And my chair kept asking me, are you sure you don't want to switch topics? And I said, no, because I will never turn in something about grief or death. I will always be finding more that I just found such a deep well of interest inside me. And I thought that the children's mindfulness sort of felt like a capstone on that. Some more of that era, I still am available for that work, but have turned more towards the grief work. And was something that I was passionate enough and would turn in. So it's sort of like this combination of like enough energy to do it and enough finished distance to be able to turn it in.
Now, in terms of like actual physical well-being, you've already alluded to some of this, but especially around pain management, you've done a lot of work in this space. I was always, you know, you and I are from the same neck of the woods, the Midwest, and I think you had a Toledo 11 news clip about pain management or a local news outlet clip back in the 80s when you were doing this. It was very cool, you know, because that was at the time kind of on the bleeding edge of that work, as far as I understand it. And you've really leveraged biofeedback, psychophysiology, applied concepts to pain management. Can you speak for just a few minutes about that? Like, you know, how effective is it? What does it look like? It's probably very similar to what you were talking about. And what are some success stories you've seen?
I was really fortunate in that, you know, during my lifetime, you know, I went to William James College, and one of the themes that they had there was that the careers we'll have 20 years from now don't exist yet. So the purpose of undergraduate school is to learn how to learn rather than to learn a job. And that's really turned out because at that time, there was no such thing as a pain clinic. Those have evolved during our lifetimes. In fact, the doctors that I first started working with were some of the first in the country who left their job as anesthesiologists and developed a private practice pain management program. And people thought they were nuts. You know, it's at the time there was no such thing. But they very early on recognized the importance of the psychological components. So that, you know, instead of psychologists trying to convince doctors, in this case, it was the doctors recruiting us to come in and teach us this interaction on it. So, you know, very early on in the whole development of pain management programs, I had a chance to start doing this. And they, again, specifically because they wanted to have the skills such as hypnosis and biofeedback as a part of it. So the important part that I think we learned fairly early about pain is that the problem with pain isn't all in your head, but the answers may be. It will be one of my little mottos that I'll when I ever get into stitching those little signs, I'll make that sign. But, you know, people are very offended if you say, well, it's all in your head, like somehow it's not real. Because pain is real if you feel it. But at the same time, pain is a perception. So when you look at ways to alter perception, hypnosis comes to the forefront. Because, you know, we, in different settings, you know, we've all read about somebody who was in an accident and was able to go 5 miles on a broken leg and weren't aware that the leg was broken, they didn't feel the pain. So we know that the brain has that capacity to alter that. So what we try to do is to give people those skills to do that on an as-needed basis. And so hypnosis really becomes one of the key tools to do that, you know, learning how to alter perception. So rather than being on stage and teaching people that they can cluck like a chicken, we try to keep them in real life learning that they can learn to deeply relax, they can change the perception of pain, they can give it size and shape and color, they can make it larger or smaller. And the first time someone learns to move a pain from the left side over to the right side, it stops being an idea that it's somehow a thing in there that has to be removed and something that they can manage in some ways. And that's a lot of times a breakthrough for people as they learn to control things.
Deal for anybody for sure, but I think particularly salient for maybe the nurse practitioner, the nurse, the psychologist, the doc, the physician. Other thoughts on that? Who would be most likely to apply and, you know, benefit from this?
Well, I would imagine, and not only am I already seeing it, but I'll even refer back again to my first experience with the Mehta Institute. It's right. The contemplative end of life specialization is right for the same folks who were in my cohort, nurses, physicians, social workers, chaplains, hospice volunteers, CEOs of hospitals.
Be a wonderful thing for those CEOs.
Yep, to have a certificate. See, so not only maybe you don't have the role that you would want to embody fully as the end of life midwifery practice in contemplative end of life specialization, but if you take in the time to work on a certificate, it would certainly inform how you are caring for those who are vulnerable and dying in your environments of care. Right, because everybody's dying. And those were the folks who were my colleagues in the cohort at the Mehta Institute. And students that I have right now are psychology students, nurses, volunteers, chaplains, I have a couple of chaplains, and family members who want to take a more intimate care of their family. I don't want to say better care, because just showing up is a good start.
Briefly describe the mind-body medicine programs. We have a master's and a PhD. What does that look like, again, in a nutshell? And for our students or prospective students that are interested in this, you can find us online, and I'll give you information on that here at the end. But Luann, what are some kind of nuggets for our prospective students out there?
Master's program, 36 units of credit, 32 units of credit, depends on what you do in your minor. It depends on whether or not you're going to do another certification. For example, you can get your certification as a healthcare coach as part of the program. And many people do that, and that is CF certified program. In our PhD program, 75 units of credit, which includes the time doing your dissertation or the credit during your dissertation. And it is original research. You put together your own question, form your own committee, get a lot of support for us. 21 units of research courses are embedded there. And you can choose a concentration. As you mentioned, mindful leadership and healthcare is one of those concentrations. But there are others too, applied psychophysiology, integrative functional nutrition, and our new programming, contemplative end of life, which is a really exciting specialization. We're seeing a lot of interest in those who have been doing hospice work or nursing work already in one form or another coming into that.
Okay, great. And so you can pursue that at the master's or PhD level, those specializations or concentrations in either program?
They're minors at the master's level. They are specializations at the PhD level.
Great distinction. Okay. And then so master's about a year and a half, 2 years. For a PhD, what are we talking about in terms of time and commitment? If a student is really motivated and they want to kind of move through and really get the information, and not only get the information, the skills, about how long are they looking at, and what's the credit unit?
You know, one of the nice things about our program is that it was flexible, so that you can take as little or as much time as you need, as long as you move through when you've met all the requirements. So if you're doing a master's, you're probably looking at 2 or 3 years. We have a capstone essay project at the end of it. So it's usually pretty limited at the end to one semester. Some people take a little bit longer. On a PhD, depends how long it takes you to do your research. So we're finding that students take 2.5 to 3.5 years to move through all their coursework. And then they can take anywhere from 1 year to 3 years doing their research, depending upon what their research.
Terrific, terrific, terrific stuff today. If you want to see the YouTube version of this podcast, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you know what to do. Go to Apple iTunes, leave that 5-star rating and review, and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Amazon, Google, Stitcher, Pandora, and many more. Remember to check our show notes for information on today's episode, including links to websites, books, etc. And for more information about our university, go to www.saybrook.edu, click on Areas of Study at the top of the page, and locate the program of your choice to learn more. Or simply Google Saybrook University. That's it for today, folks. Thank you so, so, so very much. Take care and be well.